Major Charles Rain is coming home to war. And we'd hazard there will be a few more casualties than those of the Coca-Cola Wars, though the scars may run just as deep. This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Your gear, boppers. It's time for another hard-hitting episode of Junk Food Cinema here on Film School Rejects. This is FSR's weekly cult and exploitation appreciation podcast that carries its flag of fandom into the trenches of obscure film, always sidestepping the landmines of irony. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I am joined, as per usual, by my friend and cohort.
Yeah. One or the other, or even both.
Both, I guess, if we're going to create a portmanteau out of that. But screenwriter, novelist, C. Robert Cargill.
Hi, everybody.
Screen novelist. I'm going to create a portmanteau out of that as well.
I'll get my gear.
All right. I want to remind you guys that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes if you just search for Junk Food Cinema in the podcast section. We're also on Stitcher Radio. While you're on iTunes, if you want to go ahead and give us a 5-star ranking and leave a review, that would be really awesome. We'd appreciate that. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, and on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. And of course, the Amazon links that we have here on the page. If you decide that we've piqued your interest about the particular title we're talking about and you want a good place to pick it up, we'll have the Amazon link right there for you. Or if you're going to use Amazon for anything, just go ahead and use that link and get to Amazon. And then whatever you buy, it benefits us, and we really appreciate that. But starting this show, as Dick Miller once said of us, I'm feeling very giddy today. I'm feeling especially giddy, and the reason for this swell of giddiness is that we're talking about one of my favorite exploitation films of all time, Rolling Thunder.
Which is not just one of our favorites.
Yeah.
It's not just one of Quentin Tarantino's favorites.
Nope.
One of his favorites so much that he named his entire video distribution production company after the movie.
Yep.
It is also one of the singularly best revenge movies ever made.
Definitely.
And it is one of the deepest, best scripted revenge movies ever made. It is a movie that on the surface looks like pure exploitation, but in truth is pure cinema. And is just really one of those great movies that demands a singular episode about how awesome it is.
And you think about other movies that seem like exploitation, you know, just if you were to somebody describe the plot to you, or if you were to just take a cursory glance at it, you might think, oh, that's just exploitation. A movie like Taxi Driver kind of comes to mind. It's if you were to just have somebody describe to you, it's about this crazy taxi driver, shaves his head into a mohawk and tries to assassinate a politician, you might think, okay, that sounds like, you know, drive-in fare. But then it's like, oh, but it's Martin Scorsese. And more importantly, yeah, I said it, it's written by Paul Schrader. Paul Schrader wrote Taxi Driver and also wrote today's film Rolling Thunder. Paul Schrader is a really, really fascinating guy. He's written a number of great films. He's directed a couple of films that didn't quite, you know, didn't quite have the lasting effect of some of the movies that he wrote.
He's totally nuts.
He's totally nuts. And he came out of that same, what they called the film brat generation of, you know, Martin Scorsese and Steven Spielberg and Coppola and guys who basically got started because of their love of film. I mean, very much a movement that isn't mirrored on that level again until the 90s with people like Quentin Tarantino emerging on the scene. But Paul Schrader, even though he got kind of lumped into that film brat category, he didn't see, because of his upbringing, he didn't see a movie until he was 18 years old.
Yeah. And who was it that introduced him to film and cinema?
I believe that was Pauline Kael.
It was Pauline Kael, legendary film critic, and the goddess at which most film critics worship at. She is, for those of you that aren't familiar with Pauline Kael, if you're listening to a podcast like this, you need to go out and invest in buying at least one Pauline Kael collection.
Definitely.
If not, just Googling her online and reading a bunch of her reviews. But once you read her reviews, you will understand that this woman was tapped into film in a way that most critics then or today aren't. She is really one of the singularly best film critics ever to exist. And she would pluck these people out of obscurity and be like, you, I'm going to teach you about movies. And Paul Schrader was that. She was fascinated by his upbringing and the fact that he hadn't seen film and that she could somehow be involved in shaping someone's view of the world. And she totally distorted him into this crazy fucked up dude who then went on to write some of the most fucked up films of their time.
Yeah, and that's what's great is that I think his journey into film is one that can be appreciated by at least one person in this room. You know, he studied
both
film.
Both of us.
He became a film critic, a protege of Pauline Kael, and then from there became a filmmaker. So he took the critic into filmmaker track. And one of the things that he was a huge fan of The Wild Bunch, and he wrote this very seminal piece on Sam Peckinpah and The Wild Bunch and was just very kind of taken by that movie. And that ends up actually being a huge influence upon Rolling Thunder. Rolling Thunder, for those of you who haven't seen it, the basic story is that it follows a couple of POWs, Major Charles Rain and his buddy Johnny, and they are returning to Texas after being in a Hanoi prisoner of war camp for many, many...
2,553 days.
Yes, 2,553 days. So they've been there quite a while. And as they're coming home, you know, they're obviously heralded as heroes. And one of the things that the small town does for him is they give him a silver dollar for every day he's been in captivity. And it's just
and
sort
a
of,
nice new red Cadillac.
Yep.
And a bracelet worn by a beautiful hot single lady.
Indeed. So, you know, he's trying to get his life back on track. Obviously, you've been gone that long. A lot of things have changed. There's life. It becomes a readjustment. But wouldn't you know it? Here comes a group of good old boys who decide that they want to steal, and I want to repeat this, $2,553 worth of silver dollars, so much so that they are willing to cut off Charles Rain's hand, murder his wife and child, and leave him for dead. I want to repeat this. Over $2,553 worth of silver dollars.
In the early 70s, which, you know, where the value of the dollar was about, you know, 4 to 6 times less than what it is now.
Still, man,
think
that's
about
a
the
lot.
Fact that $10,000 to $20,000 seems over the top. But
it's a lot of carnage for what seems like even with inflation seems like a small amount of scratch. That's all I'm saying.
But that scene, you know, we kind of jumped ahead in that, you know, that is the big turning point of the movie, and that is ostensibly what the film is about. Though that happens 40 minutes into the movie. You know, this is 40 minutes. The first 40 minutes of this film is about two guys returning home and focusing on one guy and what he goes through. And then this horrible thing happens to him. And despite all the horrible shit that's happened up to this dude to this point, he is not cracked. He has been fucking rock solid.
Yeah.
And then these guys take the bridge too far. And then he's like, oh, no. Fuck no. And that's the beauty of the film, and we're going to examine all these points. But yeah, this is a film about this guy who's been through some shit and then goes through some real shit, and then it's on. And they really fucked with the wrong dude, and this dude then goes about this wonderful, wonderful revenge streak that is set up and is a slow burn and turns into what is, in my book, one of the greatest revenge films of all time, and hands down.
And part of that is that it's not so focused upon the revenge aspect that comes to define the movie. In fact, I think, you know, as you were saying, like, it's really about two guys and the way that they deal with coming home from the war and how – well, okay, for example, I love – one of my favorite things about this movie is the juxtaposition between Rain and Johnny. Rain is played by William Devane, who could not be cooler in this movie if he tried.
He tried in many other movies and was never nearly as cool as he is in Rolling Thunder.
And by that I mean he has this sort of like, if you're familiar with the actor Christopher George, Christopher George is one of those guys that turns up in movies all through the 70s and early 80s, and every single performance from him, he seems like he could not give two shits about the movie he's in. And it comes off as sort of this like effortless cool type of thing. And that's very much what William Devane has going on here.
Like Steve McQueen effortless.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's this, you know, they both have the same kind of blonde good looks. And there's something that reminds me like early on in this film where he's just pure cool. And it reminded me of the beginning of Magnificent Seven when Steve McQueen is driving that stagecoach up the road. And, you know, they have that great, you know, exchange, you know, did you get elected? No, but I got nominated real good. It's like that level of cool. Like no matter how rough shit is and how bad it is, this guy doesn't give a fuck. and is just cool saying every word. And that's how Devane is in this movie.
And then he's complimented by a babyface young Tommy Lee Jones as Johnny, his war buddy, who says very little throughout the whole movie. But when he speaks, he gets right to the heart of things in the most cold-blooded and wonderfully ruthless way possible. And the juxtaposition between these two guys is that, I mean, they've both recently been freed from their lives of severe and ubiquitous, really, violence. And they're both fundamentally altered by it. I mean, but where Rain wants his pre-war life back. Like, he wants to be the family man. He wants to be a good dad. And in fact, the great tragedy of the movie is that the violence finds him even in peacetime. On the other hand, Johnny is no longer comfortable in the civilian world. He is dead inside until violence reappears in their lives.
Yeah, the other juxtaposition, though, that I find really interesting and what I think is brilliant about the script, like literally brilliant, not in a, oh my God, I love this, this is kind of cool. The thing you need to understand about Rolling Thunder is this is legitimately great cinema that is far too often neglected. No matter how hard geeks keep pressing this button to tell people about this movie, people just don't know that this movie's there. And what I think I love about this is not only that juxtaposition, but the fact that William Devane lies constantly throughout the film. He lies to fucking everybody, himself, every person he talks to. Almost every scene involving Devane has two meanings to it. There's the cursory meaning that you're taking while you're watching the film, and then there's the real meaning that Schrader writes underneath it once you understand what the film's really about and you rewatch it, and there's so much fucking depth. Tommy Lee Jones never lies. Throughout this entire movie, Tommy Lee Jones is quiet, and whenever he speaks the absolute truth.
Yeah.
There's this
even to total strangers.
Even to total strangers, even to the people he loves. His wife, you know, there's a scene that we'll probably go heavily into later, but there's a scene towards the end of the movie where he's walking out the door and he knows he's probably not coming back, and his wife's like, "Where are you going?" And he just looks up and goes, "Bye, Daddy." Yeah. And you know, in that moment, what he's saying is, "I love you, Dad. You're the one that I care about." He doesn't say bye to his wife, doesn't say bye to his friends. He says, "Bye, Daddy." And you know that at that moment, you know, that he's being entirely 100% honest, even in his brevity. And William Devane's never like that. William Devane always, says one thing and means another.
Yeah.
And we'll go into that more in depth. But man, that's these guys couldn't be any more different, but you see why one's the leader and one guy will just blindly follow wherever the other guy goes.
But that honesty, you know, when the perfect stranger asks a shotgun toting Tommy Lee Jones, "What the fuck are you doing?" "Oh, I'm gonna kill a whole bunch of people."
Yeah.
There's no alibi he's trying to strike. There's no like alternate story. Yeah. That, no, I'm gonna come up with an excuse for why I'm toting this. Yeah. No, I'm gonna kill a whole bunch of people.
I'm about to kill a whole bunch of people.
I just want you to be aware that that is about to happen. And I think that was one of the really big draws for me the first time I saw this movie was how great Tommy Lee Jones is, because we all kind of have come to accept a certain type of character that Tommy Lee Jones plays, and it's usually the old, gruff, cantankerous veteran of whatever agency, usually a lawman of some kind.
No, straight talker.
No, and yeah, and this is such a different role because he's just the happiest he is in this movie. He spends a lot of the movie just sour. Like, he really doesn't
destroyed.
Like, he doesn't like being back home and being bored. He's no longer – he doesn't feel like his life has meaning anymore because the violence has been removed from, you know, a guy who is basically violent at heart. But the happiest he gets in the movie is when shit is going down. And you see this just like impish, boyish smile on his face as like he's preparing to shoot people.
He smiles four times during the movie. You know, he smiles once when he realizes – you know, there's this moment when William Devane walks in and goes, "I found him."
Yeah.
And he smiles. And then there's later on when they're about to go into the whorehouse, when he gives them the plan, he smiles. And then there's a moment when he comes through a shotgun where he's got kind of a smile. And then there's the moment when they're in the shit, people are firing at them. William Devane is shot. They're on the ground together. They exchange looks, and he just looks like a fucking kid in a candy store. He could not be happier. And that moment makes this film so fucking profound. Like, that moment defines who Tommy Lee Jones' character is. Everything you just talked about is entirely subtext. Nobody ever says a goddamn word about Tommy Lee Jones in this movie. Nobody tells you about where he is. It's all drawn out because Schrader's writing is so fucking good. I think Schrader's writing is better here than in Taxi Driver. As much as I love Taxi Driver, this movie, I think just the subtlety of the writing and how sparse the dialogue is, but how much of what's going on you really, truly understand. There's never a moment in this film that you go, why are you doing that? Why is he doing that? Like, everything makes sense.
Yeah, and that's no faint praise either.
A bunch of people.
I love the fact that you have this movie that, again, on its surface is a revenge film, is, you know, we got a lot of revenge films in the mid to late 70s, but the thing that makes Rolling Thunder stand apart is just how well it handles the Vietnam subtext and how well it handles the idea of soldiers coming home and readjust. I mean, it very much is the Deer Hunter of revenge films. Because, I mean, you've got all these like baser level satisfying elements of a revenge film, and then underneath the surface is this whole other indictment, really, of the Vietnam War. And I love the way Schrader incorporates that. And what's really interesting about that to me is that he manages to maintain that despite the fact that, you know, for years he talked about how the studio kind of, and you know, somebody came in and did a second draft of the script. And that person wasn't asked to do so by Paul Schrader. This film was initially supposed to be released by 20th Century Fox. And it was part of their, you know, when they were doing junkets, like, here's the slate of releases we got coming up. It was heavily featured because they had Paul Schrader. They had the Taxi Driver guy. They were so excited about that. And then when they actually saw the cut of the movie, they realized, oh, no, this is the violence is way too much. I mean, you know, the 70s, we think about it being a grittier time and in cinema. And, yeah, it was. But that doesn't mean that studios were super excited about violence.
Right.
And they saw this movie and they went, oh, no, this is not something we feel comfortable releasing, which is why we get that glorious AIP logo at the beginning and the Samuel Arkoff name, because it ended up falling to American
Samuel
International Pictures.
Samuel Z.
Arkoff. Who for years growing up, I thought his last name was just Zarkov. So it was Samuel Zarkov.
Because he was the scientist from Flash Gordon.
From Flash Gordon, exactly. And the original draft of the script, this is where it gets really – like, there are certain scenes in this movie. You say, like, you know why everyone is doing everything. There are a couple of scenes that the first couple times you watch this movie, you're going to be like, this feels really off. And one of those scenes has to do with Tommy Lee Jones' family at the end of the movie having this really banal and borderline offensive conversation about – manufacturing in America,
right,
and how cars and nothing good. Basically, the gist of the conversation is nothing good is made by white people anymore, and that really upsets their elderly patriarch. And you're just kind of sitting there going, "What the?" I mean, first of all, Tommy Lee Jones' brother-in-law looks like he is Mexican, so for him to kind of have this, like, in fact, he's the one that says the only color daddy recognizes is white.
Yeah,
and it's like that's a really weird line coming from you. And then you realize that the original draft of the script didn't heroicize Major Rain as much. In fact, he was a war hero who got famous, who would become a hero despite never having fired an actual shot in the war. And he's just like this burnout racist asshole. And the end of the movie is kind of has this other possible interpretation of him just indiscriminately killing Mexicans because of how he was brought up to be racist and completely xenophobic. To the point that the original draft of the script, the ending is not so cut and dry wild bunch. It's much more disturbing. Like, there might be something mentally wrong with this guy. Something much more like Death Dream, which
you mean
is
the movie The Night Johnny Came Home.
Dead of Night is another title for it. It's an early film actually by Bob Clark.
71, I think it
yeah,
is.
Yeah, about a guy who comes back from Vietnam, who his parents were told he was dead. He comes back, they're all excited, and then they realize that there is something like...
He is dead.
He is dead.
And it's an early zombie film just after Romero. And it's an interesting, cool, but the interesting thing about that movie is that movie exists. Like, Bob Clark is known for his comedies, for Porky's and,
well, I mean, most people know him from The Christmas Story. So either Porky's or
Christmas
Story.
And of course he did Black Christmas right after, you know, shortly after he did Death Dream. But Death Dream was while the Vietnam War was going on, and it was this film criticizing the Vietnam War, which was a super low budget, super independent film, because that was the only way you'd get away with that. But yeah, it was this dark movie about how fucked up the Vietnam War really was and how these guys were really coming back. And Rolling Thunder stands as one of the greatest of those films. But Bob Clark has the has the
runner
prestige.
Up.
Well, no, he's got the prestige of making the first film of that era about that. Like Bob Clark was ballsy as fuck to make that movie in that era.
And that is the kind of movie that Schrader was trying to make with Rolling Thunder. He wanted something that at the end you don't feel like the only thing you feel at the end of Death Dream is just this like overwhelming just despair for mankind.
Yeah.
You don't feel, hey, that's great for the hero who came home from war and then started eating people. Like you don't feel for the hero or the main character of the film. You just feel this overwhelming despair at the overall state of humanity. And I feel like that's exactly the kind of thing that Schrader initially wanted from the original draft. And then they came in and made it, you know, they kind of played up the whole Wild Bunch thing, which again is a major influence.
They made it more entertaining.
It is definitely more entertaining, but I would like to see somebody actually like either
restore his cut
or show me like the actual draft. But I mean, from everything when I was researching, it seems like the original ending was all about just Major Rain going off his rocker and just killing people, killing Mexicans because, you know, he thought they were the enemy.
Well, I hope that's not what he intended, because I've always loved the end of this movie.
Oh, it's great. The way it is absolutely great. And well, I would not change a frame of it.
Yeah, but one of the things I really love about this movie, of course, you know, the major plot point of this movie is, you know, he comes home, things are not well. He comes home from war and we're introduced to this idyllic opening. He comes home, you know, everybody's celebrating his return. There's a marching band, there's signs, there's this beautiful 29-year-old girl who's been wearing a bracelet since he was taken, you know, praying every day about the day he comes home. He gets this wonderful reward from the city. San Antonio loves him. He's a hero. He goes to settle down. And then his wife comes out and says, look, I've been fucking one of our friends. And it's not, you know, and it wasn't like that. And he never made a move on me. It's me. But, you know, we didn't think you were coming back. We had to move on. And he's cool with it. And it's like, oh, no, he's cool with it. You know, it's like, I understand. She's like, what are you going to do? She was waiting for him to lash out.
Yeah.
And he won't lash out at her because he, you know, he's home. He got what he wanted. It doesn't matter how fucked up things are here. He's home. He's got his son. He can reconnect. What got him through Vietnam was his son. And then, you know, the boyfriend shows up and is trying to be cool and is trying to, you know, and has a conversation with him and, you know, and it just comes out with it. He, you know, pours some whiskey for them both and brings it up and says, look, what kind of man would I be if we didn't talk about it?
Yeah.
And he's really cool with it. And Devane is just awesome. And Devane has this great moment where you think it's going one way, where you think he's really fucking with this guy by showing him how he was tortured in Vietnam.
Yeah,
and
I think he's playing mind games is what you initially think.
Yeah, you think that. But at the end, he says, look, you know how you got because the guy says, I don't know how you got through it. And he goes, look, I got through it because you learned to love your captor.
Yeah.
And he keeps having these flashbacks of the captors, and they were tortured. But everything about those captors, it was military on military. There was a certain level of honor to it. There was a certain level of acceptance. There was a routine to it. He learned to love these guys because these guys, at least he understood them. He felt – he got where they were coming from. He loved them. And so he's telling this dude, look, I love you. You know, that's how I'm going to beat you. You know, you may be fucking my wife, but I love you, man. You can't ever take that from me. You can't beat me. I'm not going to be destroyed by this.
It is the most severe on-screen instance of turning the other cheek I think I've ever seen.
Yeah, no. At its core, up through the first half of this movie, it is one of those intensely like Christian movies. Like Schrader's Christianity, his fundamentalism really shows through here. Like Devane is just pure Christian. Look, I'm going to beat you through love. And then these fucking sleazebag motherfuckers come in and take his hand and kill his wife and kill his son.
Yeah.
That's the thing is in that scene, you know, he goes through this whole thing and tells this guy, I love you. And at the end, he tells him one thing. And what does he tell him?
Don't call my kid a runt.
Don't call my kid a runt. He doesn't say, don't fuck my wife. He doesn't say, don't come around. What he says is, don't call my kid a runt.
Yeah. And that's another interesting thing, too, is that the revenge is really motivated specifically by the death of the son. In fact, when he comes to Tommy Lee Jones's house, he doesn't say, I found the men that killed my wife and son. He says, I found the men that killed my son.
Yeah. And that is the driving point of this movie. At that point, when they do that for, as you said at the beginning, for 2,553 silver pieces, silver dollars, That's the bridge too far. And at that point, that sets off his revenge. But the beauty about his revenge is not big and melodic and fucking Western-like. It is not a, you know, ten paces at sundown. It's fucking, this guy's going to shoot these guys in a fucking whorehouse. He's going to put a hook through their fucking balls.
I'm sorry, I just figured out why they're silver dollars. It's the 30 pieces of silver.
Yeah.
It's, no, that's, it's the, that's more Schrader. That is more Schrader's Christianity coming out.
Yes.
No, that's entirely why it's silver pieces.
Yes. That's exactly what this is. So this is this guy going to the point where he's like, these guys are fucking dogs. They're not fit to live.
Yeah.
And there's that great moment where Tommy Lee Jones is visiting him and he's like, you know, this can't stand, Major.
Can't let it slide, Major. They got no cause to live.
And exactly.
Like, whoa.
And that is from that point on, that's what it is, where these are dogs and they're going to die like dogs. And these guys don't care what they have to do it because they have nothing left to live for.
Well, Tommy Lee Jones, like, even right after it happens, Major Rain isn't really interested in revenge because he's going through his rehab. That's why Tommy Lee Jones has to say that to him.
I disagree.
Well, Tommy Lee Jones, he's basically saying, again, he's trying to turn the other cheek and he's just saying, well, like, what are you going to do about it? Nothing. And then Tommy Lee Jones says, you know, you can't just let it slide. They've got no right to live. You know, he says that to him because he's initially going to try to turn the other cheek again.
I've always felt from the beginning that he had that boiling and he just couldn't tell anybody. And he knew that he could tell because, again, Devane is lying through the whole movie. Devane doesn't tell the truth. You know, he lies to his wife. He lies to the guy why he's having that conversation with him. He lies to the girl that fell in love with him. You know, he lies to everybody. And Tommy Lee Jones tells him how it is. But Devane is lying. I'm convinced that Devane is lying because
I would disagree because the only character I would say that he's absolutely honest with throughout the whole movie is Tommy Lee Jones' character.
But then we come to that scene right after that where he's placing the cigarettes in the cigarette box. And that is a deliberate parallel to later in the film because what he's doing, he's training himself how to put bullets into his revolver. That's why he's putting cigarettes into a cigarette box, and that's why he's training with that. At first you think he's learning how to use the hook, but then we see that almost exact scene later where he goes and he picks up the revolver, and there he's putting bullets in. I believe that he was planning it from the beginning. It's why he never told the police who did it, because he keeps from the police all the information.
Yeah, that makes
he
sense.
And that he knew from the get-go that once that happened, these motherfuckers were going to die by his hand because they killed his fucking son, and he didn't have to tell Tommy Lee Jones the truth because he knew that at some point he would show up to Tommy Lee Jones's house and say, I found the guys who killed my son. And what does Tommy Lee Jones say?
I'll just get my gear.
That and he knew it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to have to disagree with you because I think that the one character throughout the whole film that he is never even a shred dishonest with is Tommy Lee Jones. But regardless, when it gets to that point, he knows that Tommy Lee Jones is somebody he can rely on. So when he shows up and says, you know, I found the men that killed my son. Let me just get my gear. And then there's this sort of – it's like a first day of school excitement for Tommy Lee Jones.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
getting his bag out and he's like opening it up and like
– first okay, time he smiles in the whole movie
yeah.
after we've seen him several times. You know, he's getting off the plane in San Antonio.
Wearing a Texas-sized scowl throughout most of the movie.
His wife runs up, beautiful young woman, runs up excited to see him, kisses him full on the mouth. No excitement at all. First time he smiles when he finds out that William Devane has found the man who killed his son and that they're going to go kill the motherfucker.
Yeah.
And that's when he smiles because that's who Tommy Lee Jones is. Tommy Lee Jones's performance in this movie is just so fucking good. It's so buttoned up for the first 80% of it. And when you realize why that is, it makes so much sense, and
yeah.
it's so good, and it makes every he is a great mirror for William Devane, because William Devane doesn't show emotion at fucking all.
He is the ultimate exemplar of Henry David Thoreau's most men lead lives of quiet desperation, because in that scene where his family is arguing about the nationality of various household appliances, he looks like he's about to fucking explode.
Yeah.
And he doesn't say a word, but you can just see it behind his eyes. Like,
he's
get
bored
me the
out
fuck
of his mind.
Of
it's like, why the fuck am I here? These people don't get me at all.
Right. Yeah. I mean, all of this stuff, all of this subtext, all of this, you know, below the surface stuff is going on, all wrapped up in this nice package of a 70s revenge film. And so entertaining, you know, both in terms of the relationship between William Devane and Tommy Jones, the relationship between William Devane and Linda Haynes, who plays the young girl who who kind of falls in love with him. She, you might also remember from Coffee, is the woman who starts the hair-pulling fight with Pam Grier and ends up with her hands, like, cut to shit with razor blades. So she said she had an interesting career. And what's weird about her career, actually, is that in 1980, she just quit acting. Yeah. Just stopped. Like, she did this great movie with Robert Redford called Brubaker in 1980 and then just quit acting to become a secretary. And it's like, I thought you were supposed to go in the other direction in Hollywood. I thought you start as a secretary and become a movie star.
I have a friend who had a similar career path. That exact thing happened. But she's really great in this. And what she represents in the film is so interesting. Is that she's perfect. Like, she's exactly what William Devane could settle down with. Like, she is hope. And she's hope showing up on his door and go, look, I've worshipped you since before I met you. I will do anything for you. I'm young. I'm beautiful. I've had a string of bad boyfriends. I just want a guy who treats me well and shoots straight with me. And oh, by the way, I'm also a tomboy who knows how to shoot guns and fucking likes hanging out and drinking beer. And hey, I really just want to sleep with you and just do whatever you tell me to do for the rest of my life. And he's like, that's nice and all, but I really have all these guys to kill.
Well, I think what she epitomizes, and I think this is the two, you know, women in this movie, the two women in Major Rayne's life are so important, because I think what they actually represent is, you know, Linda Haynes' character, this young girl, represents what it was like for soldiers to come home from World War II. I mean, you had a woman who was willing to, I mean, was so, you know, in admiration of what he had done and was such, you know, an admirer that she was willing to devote her whole life to him. I mean, that's very much like the Eisenhower post-war baby boom type existence, whereas his actual wife and their actual situation is way more of the sort of downtrodden and unfortunately realistic world that a lot of Vietnam vets came home to. It's like everything has changed. You know, what you did doesn't really carry a lot of currency within, you know, the world that you live in now. It's a very different type of homecoming. And that, his actual family, that's the kind of homecoming that is more, you know, in keeping with what was going on with soldiers coming home from Vietnam. And Linda Haynes, she's like the girl that, you remember that picture in Times Square of the sailor kissing?
Oh, yeah, of course.
That's what she is.
Yeah.
She's the Times Square
girl.
She's
the dream.
Yeah, she is the dream. So I think that's why, and again, like, this is all a testament to Schrader's writing. That's why she's there. That's why you have these two women in his life, because you have the post-war experience I think he thought he was going to have,
yeah,
and the post-war experience of Vietnam, which represented in his actual family.
Exactly. And this whole film is really about that. The whole first 40 minutes really are about setting that up. You know, he comes home to all this pomp and circumstance, and everybody loves Major Rayne. And, you know, there's this, you know, they've got the band and they're flying in a private jet. And, you know, there's people from town. There's a scene where he's cutting down. In fact, this is one of my favorite small moments in the film. He's cutting down this sign that they'd put up that said, send a letter to Hanoi and tell them to release Major Charles Rayne. And you realize how little these people had actually done. You know, he's, you know, they're celebrating by cutting down a sign that said, hey, write a letter to Hanoi to say, let this POW go. Like, that's how hard they were fighting to get this guy out. Write a letter.
Yeah.
And because these people cared, they
didn't
know
what to do. Because Ho Chi Minh was so in the practice of listening to letters from the enemy.
Exactly. So, you know, but that's very much what he's painting here, is this, hey, here's the glossy return home, and then there's the bitter truth. And the bitter truth is the wife that you've been, you know, you were hope was staying true, mm-hmm, wasn't. But then he's got that beautiful thing. He's like, we knew. We all knew. You know, they knew the truth of what was going on, and he didn't care, because what he was living for wasn't his wife. It wasn't the at-home experience. It was getting home to see the son that he didn't get to watch grow up. And that whole experience is being robbed from him consistently, but he's being cool about it. He's turning that other cheek. And she does offer that. She does offer that, that whole sense of, this is the dream. You know, this is the girl you were supposed to come home to,
yeah,
but didn't. You came home to the real war. And Schrader's painting what it was really like to come home the whole time, which is why I love the third act, in which there just isn't any pomp and circumstance to the revenge. There isn't. It's
a military operation.
Yeah, it's not what.
That's why they're in their uniforms.
Yeah, it's not what most people like, because that's one of the things about modern cinema is everything is so grandiose and over the top, and everything is very, you know. If you get the bad guy, you have to get the bad guy just right. And if you don't, then the bad guy's not really dead. So we can get the bad guy just right. Kill him twice, yo, because he's not really dead. Because we really need to feel that release. And this movie is just like, this isn't what that's about. This is about a guy getting right with himself and getting right with his friend and getting right with the people that fucking disrespected him and treated him in a way that doesn't deserve any honor, which is why so many of these guys die with their pants down. You know, they die in bed with whores. You know, these guys aren't, you know, dying in their big bunker. They aren't, you know, standing up and getting a fair fight. He's kicking a door open and putting shotgun, you know, he's putting buckshot in their belly.
Like a thief in the night.
Exactly. And it's this movie is, it's, there's just kind of, there's almost a samurai essence to it, of like a, you know, the old samurai code of,
if the Bushido.
The Bushido. If you live with honor, you die by honor. If you don't, I'll just fucking kill you like a dog, because you, if you don't have honor, you don't deserve honor. And that's very much what this, the end of this movie is the first half of it is this ode to Christianity. And the second half is, this is what it really is. And it's dirty and it's gritty and it's raw and there's no glory in it. And this is this is why I think it's one of the best revenge films. It's a revenge film in which there is no real glory in the revenge.
Yeah.
And ultimately, everyone suffers as a result of everything that happened. But the bad guys get what they got coming, even though the good guys may not have gotten out of it. Yeah. Like, we don't know if they survived. They don't let us know. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if William Devane and Tommy Lee Jones walk out of that fucking whorehouse, because they were already dead.
Well, yeah. And I think, too, if you kind of examine this movie through the lens of the divergent experiences of the World War II veteran coming home and the Vietnam veteran coming home, then it actually makes a lot of sense why the son would be so important to him, more, even more on the, like, more than just the basic father-son connection level. But his son is his legacy.
Yeah.
And what World War II vets had the minute they came home was this stellar legacy. World War II veterans, they're called the greatest generation.
Yeah.
They, like, as soon as they came home, they were heroes as soon as they came home. Vietnam veterans, not so much. They were spit on. They were basically blamed for, you know, however you felt about the war, there are plenty of reasons to think that America shouldn't have been in Vietnam. Fine. None of that was the soldiers' fault, and yet they bore the brunt of all of the backlash of an angry nation. So to me –
well, there's another element I want to throw in there before you continue your point, is the big difference between the Vietnam War and the World War II was these World War II soldiers fought the war, and then they won the war, and then they hopped on a ship and sat on a ship for 3 weeks waiting to get home, and they had 3 weeks of decompression. And the guys from Vietnam would hop on a plane in 18 hours after they were being shot at, or 18 hours after they're being tortured in Hanoi. All of a sudden, they're back home.
Yeah.
And anyone who's traveled a lot knows how weird it is, where one minute you're in your home, you're kissing your wife, and all is well. And then, you know, all of a sudden, 5 hours later, you're in a place where nobody speaks your language and you are completely just out of sorts. And
Canada?
Or Mexico, or, you know, we're only a 9 hour flight from the UK, my friend.
There you go.
And they speak a totally different language that you have to subtitle over here in the States.
Yeah. Cockney.
Guy Ritchie, I believe is what it's called.
Mm-hmm.
So these guys, they had this really weird night and day experience where one minute you're literally in war, and then, you know, 18 hours later, your wife is kissing you and a band is playing and you're told it's over. And it's just the weirdest thing. And that was the start of where we started to really understand PTSD, was these guys didn't have that time to decompress and compartmentalize it and discuss with everybody and go through their shit in the way the World War II guys did, where they would, you know, they talked about it on the boats and then they wouldn't talk about it again, but they get back together every 10, 20 years and they talk about World War II. And that's when it would all come out. They would cry and they let it out. Vietnam was the first time we realized PTSD existed, which leads back to your point.
Yeah, my point being that it's more than just the father-son relationship. The reason he is so adamant about avenging his son is because, as a Vietnam veteran, he has to be thinking about his legacy. and what it's what how the history books basically are going to remember his deeds and his war and his son as his literal legacy, as his, you know, biological legacy, is also representing, I think, you know, and again, I could be completely, this could be completely speculative, but I think he also represents the historical legacy. And I feel like once that's taken from him, once he knows beyond a shadow of a doubt that his legacy is sullied or it's gone, essentially, that's when the switch gets flipped.
Well, everyone, you know, when you hear these guys who are over there talk, they would always find their one thing that they would live for and that they would fight for. And I felt that Devane was always fighting for his son. There's that great scene early on where he's talking to his boy and he's like, "You don't remember me, do you?" And he's like, "No, I don't, sir." And that's the thing is when he first meets his dad, he doesn't hug him. He shakes his hand and says, "It's good to meet you, sir."
Mm-hmm.
He's like, "You don't remember me, do you?" He's like, "No, I don't." He's like, "Last time I saw you, you were 18 months old. You were running towards me on the platform going, 'Daddy, daddy, daddy.'" And that's how he remembered this kid. And he comes back and he's missed this whole section of his life. But for him, that's what he was coming back for. It wasn't for his wife. He knew his wife wasn't going to be faithful. He knew who his wife was. But his son needed a father like he had a father, and he was going to come back and be the father the same way that he was the head of the guys in Hanoi leading these guys out of the shit there. And he was going to come back and lead his son out of youth. And he was dead set on that, and he was going to be a good dad to him. And then that gets taken away. And that was the only thing he was living for. And once there's nothing that he has to live for, then all there is revenge. And like everything he was, and it's great. They have that great scene where he's like, "Oh yeah, no, I love this song back when I was alive." And you know, the girl looks at him and goes, "What are you talking about?" "Oh yeah, that's what we used to call it."
Yeah.
And that is not what he's saying. You know, that really is, as much as that may be of what they called it. What he's saying right there is, you know, "I'm a dead man. I'm dead man walking. You know, I have nothing to live for anymore except what I'm doing right now."
Which, again, was more literally the case in Death Dream.
Yes. Well, because he was
when I was alive, yeah.
They got the news that he's Death Dream is a movie about a guy who gets killed, but he comes home anyway, and he's a zombie, and then he starts killing and eating people, and it's...
Yeah.
Yeah. That's not Rolling Thunder at all.
No. And I want to point this out. We mentioned the Tarantino legacy of this film and him calling his unfortunately short-lived video distribution company Rolling Thunder after the film. There's another reference. If you are familiar with sort of the Quentin Tarantino universe, you're probably remembering that there was this fictional taco place called the Acuna Boys. It shows up in Jackie Brown. It shows up as one of the sort of fake inner commercials in Grindhouse. I mean, there's a couple of different places that you hear mention of this restaurant called the Acuna Boys. And that is also the name of sort of the band of outlaws in Rolling Thunder that are responsible for Major Rain's family's murder. So there's another parallel there.
Well, Tarantino owns a pristine 35mm print of Rolling Thunder. It is almost perfect. It is beautiful. He showed it here, God, 15 years ago, I want to say. Almost 15 years. I guess maybe 13 years ago at this point. At QT5, and it was when he was going into he'd written Kill Bill, and Kill Bill was heavily influenced by this. And what Tarantino did with QT5 was he showed two movies a night every night, except on Friday on the Friday night, which he showed all night science fiction movies. But he showed all these movies that had inspired Kill Bill, and he was watching them because he wanted to see how the He wanted to see how 10 days of these movies, how the audience reacted to the movie, so that he could see what scenes that he stole from played and what scenes that he borrowed didn't play. And he was very honest about that. He goes, he said that up front a number of times. And this was one of those movies. And that's the first time a bunch of us here in town saw Rolling Thunder, was when he came through and was just like, "I got to show you this fucking movie." And it is one of those, it is in his DNA so hard. Like when you watch this movie, if you go back and revisit Tarantino's films, you get a whole different sense of it. Now, I will say this, as much as I love Tarantino as a writer, he's no Paul Schrader. Tarantino does not write with the level of depth that Schrader wrote in the 70s. And I think again in the 90s, like his stuff in the 80s is good, but I think his stuff in the 70s and the 90s are really, you know, his best efforts. And Tarantino writes with no subtlety. You know, there's no subtlety in his work. But he was heavily inspired by this film, and this film is very much in his DNA. And if you are a Tarantino fan at all, you really owe it to yourself, because this is the film that he loves so much, he named his fucking production company, his video release production company after it. In fact, the first time I met him, I was a video store clerk in 99 at I Love Video, and he came in with Rick Linklater. And they were looking for movies, and he came up and saw a few of the things. He goes, oh, hey, do you have all the Rolling Thunder release titles? And I was just like, yes, we do, Mr. Tarantino. You know, and it was because we had an entire shelf of them. And it was, you know, because he released some really crazy stuff. And I don't know, you know, it was short-lived, but I don't know that it was ever meant to be anything more than that. I kind of feel like what Tarantino was doing was saying, hey, there's this half a dozen to a dozen films that you guys need to know about that you don't know about. So I'm going to put them out there and put my name at the top and my little face in the corner so that all you fanboys will fucking go out and watch these movies, because you need to know what Mighty P. Kingman is. Yeah. You need to know what Rolling Thunder is. And I forget how many movies they ended up putting out.
It was
out.
Very few. I mean, if it was but 10, were, I'd be surprised.
But they were – the thing is they were all cool, and they were – a gateway drug for an entire generation into the exploitation of the 70s, which led us down the road of, well, shit, how many other revenge films are there in the 70s? And then a bunch of us started watching revenge films and passing them around. And he really did. There's so much of the pop culture today that's influenced by Tarantino trying to educate us in the 90s that inspired so many of us to try to do the same thing for the next generation. And Rolling Thunder was at the center of that. And this is one of those unbelievably epic 70s films that you have to have seen in order to really, you know, grok what's great about 70s cinema.
And you know how I know that this film is better than your garden variety revenge exploitation film? We've been talking about this movie for 45 minutes, and we haven't even mentioned the fact that Charles Raine has a fucking steel hook for one of his hands.
Yeah,
and you know why? Because the actual hook of this movie is how good its fucking script is. You don't need the hook of the hook.
Yeah, no. That's just the dress up. You know, we other things we haven't mentioned, Dabney Coleman appears briefly the psychiatrist in this. You'll see him in the credits and go, what's Dabney Coleman doing here? And then you're like, even if you've seen the movie, you're like, I don't fucking remember what Dabney Coleman is. He one of the, oh wait, yeah, he's a psychiatrist. He's got three scenes in the movie. But you know, he's Dabney Coleman being a very laid back, subdued Dabney Coleman early in his career before he was Dabney fucking Coleman.
Yeah.
God, what other tiny minutiae about this film have we forgotten to mention already?
I don't know. I think we've done pretty well. But again, I think it's a simple matter of this movie could have been called No Hook Required, because it doesn't – you don't need to know that he has this – it's not about a guy who kills people with a hook. It's not a slasher film. It is a very intense, very cerebral sort of coming home from Vietnam film that happens to have elements of the Wild Bunch, and especially the shootout at the end. So that is fantastic.
Can't just let it slide, Major. They don't have any right to live.
There's a storm brewing in this man. They took his arm. They took his family and his soul. His anger is building, and it's going to explode. Now, from Paul Schrader, the author of Taxi Driver, comes a new and shattering film about a man poised on the brink of violence. Rolling Thunder.
And for this week's junk food pairing, Cargill, what are we drinking here tonight?
We're drinking Austin Beer Works Black Thunder, my friend.
Ah, yes.
You may have heard a couple of noises during the podcast.
I don't know what you're talking about.
At which we were unleashing our Black Thunder. And
we're rolling through some Black Thunder. We probably should be guzzling Lone Star, because the entirety of this film was, in fact, shot in Texas, and there are Lone Star ads everywhere.
While, you know what? I'm going to correct you there. Ye from Indiana. While Lone Star may be what it refers to as the national beer of Texas.
Oh, God, here we go.
If you're going to shoot in San Antonio and you're going to talk about San Antonio.
Pearl. Yes, I know. I may be from Indiana, but I am also an alcoholic, and you cannot take that away from me based on the region I was born in.
Well, but then why did you run to Lone Star?
Because there
are
Lone Star ads all over this movie, all throughout the background of this movie.
And yet, the Pearl Brewery in San Antonio,
I know,
Texas.
No, it would have made more sense.
Make good beer.
But none of that matters, because we're actually drinking Black Thunder.
Made here in Austin
and capturing the Rolling Thunder experience.
German-style Schwartz.
Yeah. It's a Schwartz beer. It tastes sort of like beer mixed with soy sauce, which I'm not sure how that works, but it does.
It's awesome.
It's delicious. But really,
we're not getting paid for this.
We're not, no. No, Austin Beer Works unfortunately doesn't know that we exist. But if
they did, they better send us a fucking at least case of this, because it's good stuff.
I mean,
and the Pearl Snap.
If you happen to know somebody at Austin Beer Works and want to send this link along to them, we will not begrudge them sending us a case. But for the moment, we're doing this just because we like to drink it. But really, we cannot recommend Rolling Thunder enough. It delivers all, like I said, the baser satisfactions of a revenge film, but with a standout pair of performances and a great deal of subtextual significance.
I think anyone who's a writer of any kind, whether it be film or prose or what have you, needs to examine this film and examine how this film deals with relationships and how it deals with lying, because it is so perfect in how it does it. Because William Devane lies so much to this movie, and watching it through twice really is necessary to understand just what he's saying and what he's really saying. And it's just a testament to brilliant writing on Schrader's part, and it's just a fantastic film that if for some reason you've gotten all the way through this and you have not seen the movie yet, go back now and rewatch and watch the movie and just understand how amazing this thing is.
It also has that shootout ending that would make old Sam Peckinpah mighty proud. And speaking of great endings, this show's over. Damn it. No, that wasn't good. Man, we'll do a second draft. Don't worry about it. But that does bring us to the end of another Junk Food Cinema. Thank you guys so much for joining us. I've been Brian with Cargill, obviously. Cargill, before we go, tell us where people can find you on the interwebs.
Well, right now you can always find me at Massaworm at Twitter, MASSAWIRM, or Facebook.com/Massaworm. Or next month on May 13th, you can buy my new book, Queen of the Dark Things, the sequel to Dreams and Shadows. If you haven't read Dreams and Shadows, please go out and pick it up and check out Queen of the Dark Things on May 13th.
Awesome. You can find me actually here on Film School Rejects, also at oneofus.net, which is a site that I co-founded and I co-manage. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury and on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic, which is my like professional page that I set up.
Brian Salisbury Critic, as opposed to Brian Salisbury Chef.
Brian Salisbury, recovering Legomaniac. You know, there's a lot of
douche nozzle.
Well, no, I'm not recovering from that. I still very much am.
Still very
that.
Much a douche nozzle.
You can find the show on iTunes. Just search Junk Food Cinema in the podcast section. We're also on Stitcher. We are on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. But you know what? I feel like we need to have a punchy line to go out on.
Hold on. You need a punchy way to go out?
Yeah.